10 miles out from the last shore of Sri Lanka, it was whispered, hid the secret of immortality, a golden mistletoe that grew on an uninhabited island in the middle of the sea. Every March, pilgrims would cross to the island to visit the shrine of Antony of Padua and pray to the saint who had once preached to shoals of fish. Even though the pilgrims were sometimes stranded for days by ill wind, no one ever found the mistletoe. Sinnachi lived to a century, Kanchi 10 years longer still, and one woman to 160, it was said, but each eventually met their end. For their part, the fishing folk living nearby dismissed the legend of the golden mistletoe, the colonial civil servant R.H. Bassett recorded, attributing their great age and good health to milk, the root of the palmyra, sea air and innocence of heart. Fiery toddy, he wrote, was the only thing counteracting everyone in Delft living to be about 200 years old. 100 years after Bassett recorded these magical stories of the island of Kachetivu, it's now become entwined with a much uglier narrative, one that has to do with competing ethnic religious nationalism. Earlier this week, when Prime Minister Narendra Modi accused the Congress of giving away Kachetivu in 1974, he stoked fears of renewed India-Sri Lanka conflict. The tiny island has long occupied a disproportionate space in the imagination of ethnic and religious nationalists in both countries, and tensions have been building up. Last year, journalist R.K. Radhakrishnan revealed that the Sri Lankan Navy surreptitiously planted idols of the Buddha on Kachetivu, a part of a larger campaign targeting Hindu religious shrines and cultural symbols. Tamil Nadu Bharatiya Janata Party leader Annamalai's assertion that New Delhi will seek to reclaim Kachetivu might just be election time posturing. But likely, it will empower Sinhala nationalists in Sri Lanka who cast India as a predatory threat that's always waiting to pounce. The story of the magic mistletoe should hold out one important lesson. Whatever price is on Kachetivu, it probably isn't worth the fight. Few Indians paid much attention when, in August 1956, Lok Sabha Member of Parliament Jhulan Singh raised the issue of Kachetivu. The crisis in Kashmir, the bitter legacy of partition and the business of making a new nation seem much more important, records show, than the Ceylon Navy using a barren 1.5 square mile island in the Palk Straits for gunnery practice. In a brief answer to the question, Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru replied that Ceylon had been asked to postpone, I quote, any decision to use the island for the purpose until the question of ownership was clarified. Fishing communities on both sides of the Palk Straits in fact had some use for Kachetivu, as they'd had for centuries. It was used to dry their nets, to rest, and, less publicly talked about, to hide goods trafficked from Sri Lanka to India and back again. This island, though, figured only marginally in the imagination and political discussions of the rest of the country. In 1921, though, the British colonial governments of India and Ceylon decided to hold discussions meant to stop overfishing in the Palk Straits. The government of India, British India, claimed possession of the island, arguing it was part of the zamindari of the Raja of Ramnad. Ceylon responded that it was owned by the Diocese of Jaffna. There are various records dating back which show that control of the island shifted from time to time as kingdoms on both sides of the Palk Straits rose and fell. Anyway, it didn't seem such an enormous problem. To avoid contention, scholars N. Manoharan and Madhumati Deshpande have written, the delegates at the 1921 conference agreed to run the fisheries line 3 miles west of Kachetivu, that is, towards Sri Lanka, and compensate that elsewhere so as to maintain an equitable apportionment in the fisheries domain for both Sri Lanka and India. But remember, this was only a fishing boundary, not an international border. Following independence, though, even larger storm clouds of contention began to rise over the Palk Straits. In 1952, as Sinhala chauvinism emerged as a powerful force in Sri Lanka politics, there was growing concern over the migration of ethnic Tamils. Sri Lanka's army had stepped in to stop migrants, leading one member of parliament in that country to wonder if this might lead to war with India. There would be no question of war if the migration continued unchecked, Prime Minister Dudley Senanayake caustically replied, as, and I quote, Ceylon would in that case automatically become part of India. Later, historian Urmila Fadnis recorded, Foreign Secretary Lakshman Jayakodi chimed into this debate saying, I quote, Colombo was full of illicit immigrants who were being given shelter and protected by mudalalis or moneylenders. The fear of Tamil migration grew after the Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam rose to power in Tamil Nadu. Then in 1956, Prime Minister S.W.R.D. Bandaranaike rose to power on a Sinhala nationalist program. Even though Bandaranaike and Tamil leader S.J.V. Chelvanayakam negotiated a regional autonomy agreement, historian Robert Kearney writes, the communal storm grew in momentum, exploding into riots in 1958. Early in 1954, Nehru and his Sri Lankan counterpart John Kotelawala had signed an agreement on the status of Indian origin workers brought to work on the island nation's tea, coffee and coconut plantations. 10,000 people, the Lok Sabha was told in 1956, had returned home to India after being served legal notices to leave Sri Lanka, while another 17,000 left the country voluntarily. To Nehru, the main issue was securing the rights of the ethnic Tamils who remained in Sri Lanka, not a territorial fight over an island almost too small to figure on the map. Ending the long festering maritime dispute with Sri Lanka, former Prime Minister Indira Gandhi hoped, would serve several geopolitical ends. For one, communal tensions in Sri Lanka had reached dangerous levels. The notionally left-wing Janata Vimukti Perumuna, or People's Liberation Front, had launched an insurgency in 1971, which targeted both Prime Minister Bandaranaike's government as well as the Tamil minority. To Indira Gandhi, Kachchatheevu was a small price to pay for shoring up a regime in Sri Lanka that was willing to keep the United States out of the Indian Ocean, moreover. Ira Sezian, a DMK Lok Sabha member, condemned the Prime Minister for the India-Sri Lanka border agreement on Kachchatheevu, describing it as, I quote, an unholy and disgraceful act of statesmanship unworthy of any government. DMK governments would continue to press India's claims for decades after with various degrees of seriousness. Things didn't work out quite to plan though, for two separate but unrelated reasons. The rise of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam or LTTE plunged Sri Lanka into a murderous war, deal with India or not. Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi's government allowed India to be sucked into the conflict, leading to a rapid deterioration in the relationship between the two countries. Large-scale trafficking of weapons for the LTTE also led to the militarization of the Palk Straits, as Sri Lankan forces tried to stop the flow. In principle, the 1974 agreement on the India-Sri Lanka maritime boundary gave fishing communities the right to continue to use their customary fishing grounds on both sides of the border. Executive orders passed in 1976 constrained fishing boats not to stray across the border though, and the rise of the conflict drew the line in the sea in blood. There was a second crisis. In the 1980s, fishing boomed. Development economist Ajit Menon and his co-authors have noted. Tamil Nadu's fishing fleet came to increasingly include large trawlers which could sweep the oceans for shrimp. This damaged the breeding grounds and denied small fishermen from relatively poor northern Sri Lanka their fair share of the catch. Even though communities on both sides of the border were ethnic Tamils, their interests now collided. Following the end of the war in Sri Lanka, the strains grew even more fraught. Twice in 2011 alone, fishermen from Point Pedro and Matangal captured Indian trawlers in direct action raids, scholars Jay Scholtens and his colleagues have recorded. Large numbers of Indian fishermen were and continue to be arrested by the Sri Lankan Navy each year, which fuels tensions between the countries. 5 kilometers more land we have or 5 kilometers less, this is not important, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev admonished China's Mao Zedong after clashes with India broke out in Ladakh in 1959. Like other powers, Khrushchev explained to Mao, the Soviet Union had often ceded territory to its neighbors to cultivate goodwill and secure its borders. Mao's aggressive action in the high Himalayas, he predicted, would serve only to push New Delhi towards the United States and weaken Nehru's commitment to non-alignment. Well, we can all see now that he was right. The Soviet leader's words ought to be considered carefully in New Delhi. Tempting as it might be to score political points on Kachativu, India's strategic interests don't lie in securing control of a tiny plot of land. Instead, the real challenge India faces is containing China's growing influence in Sri Lanka and the wider Indian Ocean. Fighting over territory and hostile words won't help India's cause. Alternatives aren't hard to think of. Instead of obsessing over tiny amounts of territory, New Delhi could lead a constructive dialogue on sustainable use of the fishing grounds in the Palk Straits, one that respects the rights of communities on both shores. For its part, Sri Lanka must be encouraged to temper its use of coercion against Tamil Nadu's fishing workers. Ethnicity, nationhood and greed have all collided to poison the waters around Kachativu for too long. Two nations and two peoples have already paid an unacceptable and unnecessary price. The mistakes that led to that disaster shouldn't be repeated. I'm Praveen Swami and I'm a contributing editor at The Print. Thank you for watching Security Code.